From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. President-elect Donald Trump is meeting today with more potential candidates to fill top posts in his administration. Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon, former Texas Governor Rick Perry, and even a Democrat, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, are on the schedule to be at Trump Tower in Manhattan today. Rebecca Sinderbrand is managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post. She's with us now. And Rebecca, the parade continues. What are you watching for today?
Well, we're looking for a number of things today. We've been told that there's a possibility of the announcement of some key posts, but of course, that seems to have been kind of a work in progress. Things shift very rapidly. And we're also watching to see exactly what happens in this meeting between Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard and Donald Trump.
Yeah, what's she up for?
Now, she seems to be up for, if you believe the Trump campaign, pretty much every post. She's been mentioned Secretary of State, Ambassador to the UN. Right now, all of these things seem very fluid. Right now, you hear many different people mentioned for many different posts.
And Gabbard, we should say, was a big Bernie Sanders supporter.
Absolutely. So, you know, she's a big Bernie Sanders supporter. On the other hand, she's had a lot of positions that are a bit unorthodox. She's, right now, a lot of people refer to her as kind of the Republicans' favorite Democrat, which is kind of an odd when you consider a Bernie Sanders supporter. But she has given certain positions in terms of refugees, talked about Islamic extremism, declined to sign on to an assault weapons ban a few months ago. All these are positions that put her in the same neighborhood as supporters of Donald Trump.
Yeah. So if you watched any cable news over the weekend like I did, this is quite a spectacle. Trump, of course, was at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. A candidate would come up to the door. He'd come out. He might wave, say a few words. How different is this, what Trump is doing, from the way that other presidents have done it?
It's very different. You know, the way our Chris Cillizza says to think about this process right now is a bit like performance art. The show seems to be everything. And, you know, right now we've been told to expect a video today where the president-elect will lay out his priorities for the first 100 days. Notably, this is not a press conference. We have rarely heard from him publicly since he was elected president. And so this is a very unusual way. Almost everything that he's doing at this point either takes place behind closed doors or on social media, very different from how past president-elects have handled it.
Yeah, well, on Friday, Trump settled three civil lawsuits over Trump University. This was a $25 million settlement. It could have been much bigger news over the weekend, but a lot of people have been saying that perhaps it was buried or a smokescreen because of Trump's reaction on Twitter to the cast of Hamilton confronting his VP pick, Mike Pence, on Broadway. What do you make of that?
You know, the interesting thing is, of course, that Trump himself also tweeted about the settlement several times. So if he was trying to bury it, he wasn't doing a very good job of pushing that. You know, you have to say that right now, this is not the last conflict we're going to hear about from Donald Trump. And the fact of the matter is, each of these issues presents something that needs to be or will be discussed in the days and weeks and months ahead. Hamilton itself was not obviously a very significant moment, except for how it crystallized a lot of the issues that are still swirling around how the president-elect has chosen to reach out to people who did not support him during the campaign.
Yeah, Democrats also wondering how the incoming Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer will be approaching this president. And he did give us some ideas. Here he is on ABC's This Week with Martha Raddatz.
When he's opposed to our values, we're going to go after him tooth and nail. For instance, we're not going to let him repeal Dodd-Frank or the rules we put in place to limit Wall Street. They're going to regret the day they tried to repeal the ACA. So when we oppose Trump on values or if his presidency takes a dark, divisive turn, we're going to do it tooth and nail.
Rebecca, real quickly, how do you see that relationship working out?
You know, in the past, Donald Trump has had nice things to say about Chuck Schumer. We'll see how long that lasts once he actually takes office. There's a debate right now in the Democratic Party about the best way to handle Donald Trump. It'll be interesting to see in those first 100 days what sort of relationship takes place.
Yeah, maybe some common ground on infrastructure spending. Rebecca Sinderbrand, managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post. Rebecca, thank you as always.
Thanks for having me.
Well, three ambush attacks yesterday on police officers, one in Sanibel, Florida, one in St. Louis, Missouri, and one in San Antonio, Texas, left police departments rattled and grieving. The officers in St. Louis and Sanibel are expected to fully recover. The Texas officer, Detective Benjamin Marconi, was killed, shot in the head by a suspect who drove up while he was writing a ticket. Shelley Koffler is news director for Texas Public Radio. And Shelley, we understand the suspect is still on the loose, but there is a surveillance video. What more do we know?
Well, some of this information, Robin, was just released this morning. There was apparently a man who approached police headquarters in downtown San Antonio about 4 hours before the traffic stop and the shooting. His image was captured on videotape. He was seen walking into police headquarters. The police chief told us this morning he then approached the clerk at the desk, asked a question. We don't know what that question was. It wasn't revealed, and then left. But the police surveillance videos released today show a pretty clear picture of the person's face, and they show his image as he goes in and out. And so while he is not in custody, police are calling him a suspect, and they believe that he is very probably linked to this shooting.
Well, all of these attacks are so disturbing, chilling. On November 2nd, two officers were assassinated as they sat in their squad cars in Iowa. So is there any sense of whether this was a personal attack? I mean, I know, you know, this is early days, but was it just an attack on law enforcement or something more direct?
Well, I can tell you, you know, the police chief this morning said that he and officers feel targeted, and he said, quote, the uniform was the target. So it's believed that this suspect was clearly after an officer. We don't know whether this suspect was after this particular officer, whether there was some personal problem there, or whether it was any officer. And yes, our cities, you know, the tensions here are heightened over all of this, too, like just about every community in the country. The many police shootings over the past year or so has rattled our community. And we actually now have a community relations group that meets with police, and they're trying to make sure that things stay under control here in this situation that, of course, didn't happen.
Yeah. And just very, very briefly, you know, what are people saying to you? Law enforcement rattled. How about people?
Well, I think everybody's concerned. You know, San Antonio prides itself on not having a lot of tensions that flare up beyond control. San Antonio prides itself on bringing the parties together and working problems out. I think that, you know, it remains to be seen how the community will handle this in terms of tensions. And I will say there's been an outpouring of support from the entire community.
Shelley Koffler of Texas Public Radio. Well, let's go to Missouri now, where a fourth officer was shot outside Kansas City while attempting to take a suspect into custody. He's expected to recover, as is the officer ambushed in St. Louis. Rachel Lippman is with St. Louis Public Radio. And Rachel, this officer was in his squad car when a suspect pulled up and shot him in the face. He was driving at the time?
Apparently slowing down to accommodate traffic who was slowing in front of him. He was not involved in any kind of traffic stop or engaging with the suspect in any way. They believe, St. Louis Police Chief Sam Dotson believes that the suspect knew he was wanted for a series of other violent crimes in the area and was worried that he possibly might be recognized by the officer.
So he's suspected of being connected to a homicide, actually, on Saturday?
Homicide, some robberies, and potentially a carjacking. They haven't released everything that they believe he was involved with, but it was an individual known to police officers. They knew him by name, and they believe that he and a group of friends were responsible for a rash of incidents in a neighborhood not too far from where the shooting took place and where that suspect was later shot and killed by police.
And what was that? Was that a standoff, or did they track him down?
They had tracked him down, according to Police Chief Sam Dotson. They found the vehicle that was involved in the initial shooting downtown near a casino and tracked the gentleman and a friend back to this neighborhood. After a short pursuit, he got into another exchange of fire with undercover officers and officers from the Special Operations Unit and was killed in that shootout.
We should say that there was another police shooting outside Kansas City, Missouri, and this was an officer that was trying to take a suspect into custody.
Yes, this was actually after a traffic stop, according to the Kansas City Star. He had pulled over a vehicle and was attempting to pursue an individual who had been in that car, and that suspect was shot and killed in a struggle. As you mentioned earlier, the officer in Gladstone, Missouri, is expected to survive. He is out of surgery.
Yeah, but to the the ambush, the shooting through the window of the officer. There were two officers assassinated while they sat in their squad cars in Iowa on November 2nd. And, of course, our minds go back to the summer, July 7th, the ambush killing of five police officers in Dallas. And then on the 17th, six officers were shot by a sniper. Three of them died in Baton Rouge. What are nerves like there in the police department?
It's certainly on their minds. Chief Dotson at a press conference last night after the initial shooting said that officers would be riding two to a vehicle for the time being. Mayor Francis Slay called it a tragedy for the city, for the officer's family, and for the department itself, and said that basically, this proves how dangerous of a job this is, and we need to be supporting our police officers. Governor-elect Eric Greitens, who is a Republican, he called for the strictest possible punishments for anyone who assaults a police officer. And he's also pledging to create a blue alert system similar to an amber or a silver alert that would push out emergency notifications with suspect information about those suspected of killing or shooting and wounding a police officer.
Rachel Lipman with St. Louis Public Radio. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Can a cooking show succeed on Broadway? Well, the likelihood certainly increases when the show stars Alton Brown, the same man whose current Food Network series, Cutthroat Kitchen, is a cult hit. It's a bizarre contest between chefs who might be forced to cook in huge oven mitts or use an easy-bake oven. Alton auctions off these so-called sabotages that contestants can buy and make their opponents use.
In my hands, I have a variety of ice cream cones. When this auction, you can force your opponent to do all of their mixing and cooking inside these extremely fragile little things. Oh, gosh, I already broke one.
$2,000.
Do I get 21?
So, an ice cream cone as a mixing bowl, or a challenge to make a pizza with a crust of an apple pie. Alton Brown is also the creator of the Food Network's longest-running show, Good Eats, which includes as much science and culture as it does recipes.
The flavors in pepper come mostly in the form of oils. Oils love getting together with other forms of fat, such as those found in egg yolks. Which, of course, you would use to make deviled eggs. The term of deviling eggs comes from 18th century England, where the word deviled, you'd mint anything that was stuffed with a spicy filling.
Alton Brown also had a touring roadshow, Edible Inevitable. It hit 120 cities in 2 years, starting in 2014. It evolved into a brand new show, Eat Your Science, which had a tryout in upstate New York and is opening on Broadway at the Barrymore tomorrow. Move over Hamilton. Eat Your Science is a two-hour extravaganza featuring music, experiments, demonstrations, audience participation. And Alton also released his eighth cookbook, Everyday Cook, recently. We caught up with him at his publicist's office in Times Square and got a sense of his raw energy. He's a man in a hurry to create. Pity the office phone that gets in his way.
Okay, so you just unplugged somebody's phone.
Yeah, we're here.
It reminds me of another part in the book. It calls for a 12-inch skillet, and you say, if you don't have a 12-inch skillet, get one.
Yes. I should have tempered that, and I think I even did in my corrections page. It was saying, okay, 10's good too. 10's fine. I prefer 12, but there's a lot of weight difference between a 10-inch cast iron skillet and a 12-inch cast iron skillet. And I'm not even sure certain – like cabs in New York, I don't think will take you if you've got a 12-inch cast iron skillet. I'm not sure.
We began by trying to describe his new Broadway show, Eat Your Science.
I've come up with – it's as if Garrison Keillor, instead of like just having the muffins, he blew up the muffins. How would you introduce yourself to an audience that wouldn't know you?
Well, I sure as heck wouldn't pull out Garrison Keillor by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, no, if he was like really demented.
It's funny. Back when I started my show, Good Eats, when I first wrote kind of the memo to myself about that show, I wrote three names down. I wrote down Mr. Wizard, Julia Child, Monty Python. And I was like, if I can put those three things together, I'll have something. And I think I'm still just riding that. I mean, I have not wavered from that one little Post-it note.
But you've added in, with the new Broadway show, Let's Veer Over There, you've added in, there's a variety show, musical aspect, and
yes.
Puppets.
Yes, puppets, music. Well, if you're going to do a variety show, I mean, one of my things I always wanted to reinvent or kind of push the boundaries or find the edges of the map when it comes to culinary entertainment. And a couple of years ago, I'd been doing a lot of live demos, and I always really enjoyed live audiences. I was a theater major. The more I did them, the more I was like, I'd really like to do a larger show. You can't do that as a one-off because it's too expensive. And so that's when I started thinking, nobody's ever done a culinary variety show. And I was a child of 70s television. So variety shows like Sonny and Cher and Carol Burnett, all those shows, I loved them. And so I got to the point of, well, I want to do a variety show. But you know what? If you're going to do a variety show, you have to have music. There have to be songs. So I started writing food songs and learned how to play guitar and started putting the rest of it together. Puppets had always been in the DNA of my work ever since the late 90s. And so putting that together with very large, very unusual food demonstrations, unlike anything that I could do on TV. And that's another thing is basically it's 2.5 hours of things I can't do on television.
Well, it turns out that you can do just about anything you want.
I don't know if I can do anything. I will say that I think that food is a very deep, rich reservoir of material. And in this day and age where we are separated by so much from each other, we're unified by food. Everybody wants to enjoy food in a group environment. And so what's a theater? Well, it's a group environment. So I don't think it's a big stretch. When you really understand that food is a connective tissue that brings people together, you can kind of do anything. Well,
but did I read that – so you were studying the arts in theater and cinematography. You weren't a foodie. You thought, well, maybe food could be the avenue.
I was a hobbyist cook and had been since college. I had learned how to cook to get dates. I found that girls that said no, if you asked them out, would often say yes if you offered to cook for them. And so that became my hobby. And then after directing commercials for a few years, I found myself watching more and more food shows. But I noticed that they were all kind of boring and I didn't actually learn anything. And I started thinking, somebody really ought to make a food show for my generation, for like the MTV generation. And then I suddenly got the crazy idea, wait a second, maybe I could do that. So I quit my job and went to culinary school.
Just want to insert here, perhaps in the interest of full disclosure, when you were saying that the early cooking shows were kind of boring, perhaps you are not aware that I was the original host of Ready, Set, Cook on the Food Channel.
Yes, I am fully aware of that.
You know,
I was speaking more of instructional cooking shows, not
game straight shows.
I know you and I are tied by a certain DNA because we have both hosted culinary game shows.
I'm in awe of what you've done because the most exciting thing that I did, which we thought was pretty exciting at the time, was when I said, ladies and gentlemen, cast your avocados. That was my idea.
You came up with cast your avocados? That was you?
Yes, thank
Holy
you.
Holy moly.
I know.
Ladles, soup cans, and loaves of bread.
But Alton Brown has taken the cooking game show to dizzying heights in Cutthroat Kitchen. Here, contestants vie to buy a sabotage that will force their opponents to cook in a loaf of bread.
If you win this auction, you can assign each of your opponents one of these options to do all of their mixing and cooking in.
I have got to go on the offensive and sabotage the other chefs.
$1,000 bid.
Well, Cutthroat Kitchen, people say, well, it's a culinary competition. It's actually not. It's a game show. You have to play a game. Of course, the whole thing is to avoid these hideous sabotages, which I'm not. I'm a highly functioning sociopath, but I'm not full-on sociopath or psychopath, which is what that would require to come up with all of those sabotages. So there's actually five of us that come up with those. A lot of my ideas never see the light of day because they're just too messed up.
Like what?
Well, there was the coat of cats. I wanted to make somebody wear a coat of living cats, and that went away very, very quickly when people realized that I actually wanted, like, zip-tie cats' little paws together and make somebody wear them. Things like that. But, you know, these meetings get really long, and you're trying to shake things up, and all of a sudden you find yourself saying coat of cats and cast your avocado.
Let's talk about the new Broadway show. What are the kinds of things you wanted to put in this show?
Live music is in it. Puppets are in it. Two very large, very unusual demonstrations involving things that cannot be found in the normal, ordinary kitchen.
Oh, come on. Give us a hint.
No. All I'm going to say is that all of my shows are built on having one demonstration that's about cold and one demonstration that's about hot. The real challenge, though, is theaters don't like fire. So you can't make flame in these theaters, you see, and that limits one. The first show, I built an easy bake oven that was 8 feet tall and 12 feet long, 15 feet long. That was powered with an awful lot of light, generated about 1,026,000 lumens of light, and would cook a large pizza in 3 minutes. That's been replaced with something larger this time.
Let's talk about the cookbook. Everyday Cook. Yes. There you are. Looks like you lying in bed with French fries.
Yeah, with French fries. That's me in my bed with French fries. My decision had been that I wanted to shoot the whole book with an iPhone and to do every shot from overhead, directly overhead. That's why the book kind of looks peculiar, which I like. I don't think anybody's done a book that looks like this. But it was time for me to do a personal project. I had never done a personal book. My seven previous books were all either extensions of TV shows or the recipes were created specifically for a book. These are just 101 of my recipes.
So talk about mayonnaise.
It's a great texture addition to scrambled eggs. It's an emulsion that you can use as a protecting agent. And it also, I slather it on fish when I grill fish because it's a great nonstick because it's not like oil. It won't just run off.
Can I ask also about saltines?
Yeah.
You spent a lot of time on them.
I don't spend a lot. What are you talking about?
I mean,
I have one saltine recipe in here. But
I meant you spend it. You. Some of us just take the saltine and eat it.
I like to hack things. It's like, to me, a saltine is a blank canvas ready to be somehow abused or highlighted into something else. They're the hacked saltines. And notice that I've plated them inside a Kodak slide carousel. But I look at any bit of food, manufactured food like that, a classic like a saltine, and I'm like, okay, we can just say that's fine. That's done. But is it done? Could we make that better? And I'm like, yeah, give me some hot sauce and butter and we'll make a slather, as I call for it, that's got a lot of stuff in it, but it's mostly butter and hot sauce. And you slather them on and rebake them. And it just sets into the cracker and gives the cracker a nice sheen and an incredible depth of flavor. So you could do it with matzah too.
Since we are in New York, when you're here, you're from the South. Like, what do you look for here? You know, I'm from New York, and so I still seek out the deli that hasn't changed in 50 years, but it's become pretty homogenized. What do you look for when you come here?
I spend a lot of time perusing the Lower East Side, like you, constantly looking for the vanishing, whether it's a really great smoked fish dive or a better bagel. If it's got a Michelin star, I just don't care. I will not go to a Michelin star restaurant. Michelin's a tire company. Somebody should think about that sometime.
Alton Brown, his new show Eat Your Science opens on Broadway tomorrow, begins touring the country in March. His new cookbook is Everyday Cook. For more on both, go to hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
And yesterday was International Transgender Day of Remembrance, an annual event to mark acts of violence against transgender people. Thousands gathered across the country to show solidarity. In New York, a healthcare network that serves the poor and uninsured held a dinner for its transgender clients. John Kalish was there.
The Community Healthcare Network has 14 transgender staff members, and this weekend, many of them attended a Thanksgiving-style dinner of turkey stuffing and pumpkin pie at the Fashion Institute of Technology in Manhattan. Lorena Lopez is a patient retention specialist who also performs in a nightclub act with 5 other transgender women.
In this room now, we have people, they've been beaten. One of the girls, she was in the hospital for almost a week. We didn't know if she was going to make it through. And thanks God she's here. She's eating dinner with us.
Most of the transgender clients who attended the dinner are Latino, and many are sex workers. One trans woman who spoke through an interpreter told me she was hospitalized for a month and a half after being attacked.
In November del año pasado.
It was in November last year. She was in a coma 20 days after her attack. She came out of the hospital. She didn't have full movement of her arm.
According to one healthcare worker at the dinner, there have been 26 hate crimes committed against transgender individuals this year in the New York borough of Queens alone. The group that coordinates the Transgender Day of Remembrance says 24 transgender people were murdered in the United States so far this year.
So I just want to pay homage to all of our fallen sisters and just all the people who have paved the way that we can, you know, get up and go out and walk down the street and work jobs and live our lives and be who we are.
Many of the healthcare workers and activists at the dinner noted the high suicide rate among transgender people. A trans woman from Argentina named Cecilia Gentili told the gathering of her dark days as a homeless heroin addict and prostitute facing deportation.
It was a group of people, mostly trans women, who saved my life because I didn't want to live anymore. And that is what I want to highlight tonight, the power of community.
Community Healthcare Network CEO Bob Hayes made a name for himself in the early 1980s, serving another vulnerable population. He won a landmark class action lawsuit on behalf of the homeless, establishing the right to shelter in New York. Hayes told his transgender clients, "We will stand with you."
We don't know what's going to happen with national health policy. We don't know where the money is going to come from. I don't care. Community Healthcare Network will be here for our patients, giving the kind of comprehensive care that folks deserve. We're going to keep it happening.
Hayes told the group the movement for transgender rights has made a lot of progress in recent years, but that 2017 could be a precarious time for the movement, with a new president and Congress coming to Washington. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish in New York.
We're watching the latest parade of interviews taking place at Trump Tower today in Manhattan as Donald Trump's administration begins to take shape. He's already appointed retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn as his national security advisor, and there's speculation that retired Marine General James Mattis is a top contender for Secretary of Defense. Trump had high praise for Mattis after the two met yesterday.
He's just a brilliant, wonderful man. What a career, and we're going to see what happens. But he is the real deal.
Fighting the Islamic State will be at the top of the agenda for whoever gets the job. Seth Jones is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. His new book is Waging Insurgent Warfare, Lessons from the Viet Cong to the Islamic State. Seth, welcome back.
It's great to be on. Thanks, Peter.
Sure. So what do we know about General Mattis and his reputation?
Well, General Mattis has had strategic and operational experience on several battlefields, from Iraq to Afghanistan to holding the very senior positions within the U.S. military. He is widely known and respected as a strategic thinker with, again, with vast experience in fighting both insurgent groups, but also historically understanding the political nature of warfare, not just the military.
Is he equally respected by Democrats as well?
From my experience, he's respected virtually by everybody, both Republicans and Democrats. Everybody has their detractors, but his experience both in Washington but also around the world in multiple deployments means that he's got a pretty well-respected group of supporters, I think, across the board in Washington.
Oh, there's also Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who has been named National Security Advisor by Trump. Now, Flynn is a more controversial figure. He's called Islam a cancer. What do you make of Michael Flynn? Does his appointment tell you anything about the way that a Trump administration will treat policy in the Middle East and specifically with ISIS?
General Flynn has had experience in places like Afghanistan. He worked as a senior intelligence officer for NATO ISAF in Afghanistan under General McChrystal. He's had a lot of experience dealing with al-Qaeda and the Taliban. He's written about combating these kinds of groups, including ISIS. So I think one thing it does tell us is that he and several members around Donald Trump will focus on this kind of warfare. There's been a shift a little bit towards dealing with the Chinese and the Russians in the latter part of the Obama administration. I think the next administration will, among other things, focus on ISIS.
Well, I'm looking at what's happening with the efforts in Mosul right now in Iraq, trying to get ISIS out of that stronghold. When you have someone like Michael Flynn sitting at the right hand of Donald Trump advising on national security, I mean, do you see him taking a different path than the Obama administration is in Iraq?
Well, look, I think it's unclear right now. Most of the policy has not been established for a new administration. They'll probably wait till they take over in January to actually make decisions. Between now and then, I think the issue is to better understand the conflicts and to start making and looking at options for how to deal with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. I think Iraq's a bit of an easier case. I suspect that based on the fact that ISIS has lost territory, not just in Mosul, but in Anbar province, the focus will be on pushing them out. I think the more serious issue and the harder one will be what to do in Syria.
Okay, let's talk about that. And this will bring us back to your book. You write that there's been about 200 or so insurgencies since World War II. And of course, we are today most interested in this fight against ISIS. But what is the state of ISIS right now? Is it on the run when you consider what's happening in Mosul? You say maybe the situation in Raqqa or Syria is a little bit different. But what is the state of the ISIS insurgency right now?
I would say there are two sides of answering this question. The first is that ISIS is an insurgent group and that it wants to, it needs to control territory. And on that front, it has lost ground in virtually everywhere that has a footprint. It's lost ground in Iraq. It's lost more than 50% of the territory it controlled at its peak in 2014. It's lost control of territory in Syria. It's lost it in Libya, where it had a footprint in places like Sirte. It's lost it in Afghanistan. It's lost it in Nigeria. So across the board, it's lost territory. On the other hand, one of the things that ISIS has not done is stopped its attacks, including in the West. So you have these two trends that are, in a sense, pushing against each other, a decline in territorial control, but a pretty significant up-tempo in conducting attacks overseas.
It's fascinating because you write in your book, you know, don't necessarily count ISIS out just because it's losing territory. In fact, they do have options. Often history shows us that when an insurgency is on the run, that it goes and it seeks out sanctuaries to regroup. Do you see that happening here?
Well, I think it's possible. I think ISIS does get a vote in what happens over the long run. And I think what it already looks like it's doing in places like Iraq, so it's lost territory in Mosul, but it has looked for sanctuaries in some of the areas around the Iraq-Syria border. It's pushed some of its fighters into Syria itself. It's discouraged a number of others from coming to Iraq and Syria and focused them on fights in Libya or in Nigeria. Over the long run, I think we have to see this organization as trying to fight on multiple fronts.
Do its tactics change?
If the organization wants to survive over the long run, I think what it has to do is it has to decrease its use of really violent attacks against civilians. That has undermined popular support. One of the things we see in Mosul from interviews with individuals that have come from liberated areas of Mosul and other places in Iraq is they really did not like the massive use of violence against civilians by ISIS. So I think if it has any chance of surviving over the long run, it's got to moderate its targeting of civilians.
Well, what about the long run? Because insurgencies over the last couple of decades can last decades. What does history tell us about that?
Well, history tells us that first and foremost, insurgencies are political, not military. And for an insurgency to persist and even to win over the long run, they need to be able to undermine a government. They need to take advantage of local grievances. These grievances can be economic, they can be ethnic, they can be religious. So one of the things I think that people have to focus on as ISIS continues to lose territory is, are these grievances that have helped ISIS gain sanctuary in places like Iraq or in Syria or in Libya, are these grievances being addressed? And if not, then the question is, will ISIS return or will some jihadist group like ISIS be able to fill this vacuum? And one of the things that's causing a little bit of concern for me is where ISIS has lost territory in places like southern Afghanistan, for example, in Helmand and Farah, the vacuum has been filled not by the Afghan government but by the Taliban, which is another violent insurgent group. So the key question in many of these cases is what comes next.
Of the insurgencies that you studied, you write that about 35% of them end with a victory over the government. About 36% of the time, the government will put down the insurgency. And 29% of the time, it just ends in a draw. What does it look like if ISIS wins this fight?
Just the basic version of governance and justice that ISIS holds in areas that they control is antithetical to everything that we hold dear in the United States and the West. So it would be a terrible outcome for them to win in any conceivable way.
But that may be the very thing that makes it harder for them to win, because they can't win over or have a harder time winning over the hearts and minds of the people in the area.
One of the things that ISIS has done, and a lesson that it has not learned, is that insurgent groups that use what I would call a punishment strategy and punishment tactics, that is, targeting civilians, generally don't win. It's one of the strongest findings from looking at 200 insurgent groups since World War II, is punishment is not an effective strategy, and ISIS continues not to learn this lesson. And in a sense, it's a good thing for us, because their use of brutality against civilians undermines the very thing that successful insurgents like Mao, for example, argued, and that is the success for an insurgency is about winning the hearts and minds of the local populations. Mao likens insurgents to fish that need the water, the civilians, to succeed, to breathe, in a sense.
He told his fighters not to steal from civilians and to make the bed before they leave if they're staying in their home.
To treat local civilians with respect, and that is something that ISIS has not done. If you look at the last 200 or so insurgencies, ISIS's inability to win support from areas that they control will almost certainly be its death knell.
Seth Jones, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND, his new book is Waging Insurgent Warfare: Lessons from the Viet Cong to the Islamic State. Seth, thanks as always.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Over the weekend, Mark Zuckerberg addressed the problem of fake news on Facebook, saying Facebook's working on stronger detection. Last week, Google's CEO said fake news sites bankrolled by Google-served ads could have swung the election in President-elect Trump's favor, and they were viewed more than traditional news sites. The day after the election, the New York Times did an anatomy of a false tweet that a 30-something Austin businessman sent, concluding that people were being bussed into Austin to protest Donald Trump's election because he saw a lot of buses. But it was completely false. The buses were for a private conference. The story, though, was shared and reposted hundreds of thousands of times. Even Donald Trump claimed it was true. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He's given this all some thought. He joins us as he does every Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hi there.
And the story of the Austin tweet is so instructive. The man didn't vote for Trump. He voted for a third-party candidate. He just sent it out. He said, I don't have time to fact-check, and I only have 40 followers. Then boom. Your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, one can sympathize with the person who sent the tweet, right? We've all passed along something or other. It's an email. It's a Facebook post. It's a tweet that seemed true and then turned out not to be. The question is, how does an accidental tweet from somebody with 40 followers get thousands and thousands of retweets? And the answer to this sort of question is that typically it's not the person who tweeted it, who sends it, who's responsible for its widest distribution. It tends to hit some broadcaster. Someone with tens of thousands of followers who picks it up. And in this case, the article was picked up by a Reddit page that favors Donald Trump. It was picked up by a conservative website, Free Republic, and it was picked up by a popular Facebook page, Robertson Family Values, which is associated with the men from Duck Dynasty, that incredibly popular cable television show, which that Facebook page has 1.1 million followers. That's almost as much as The Atlantic, which is the magazine that I work for. So, you know, It itself is essentially a broadcaster. So what's happened, I think, what we've seen is that there is this network of conservative broadcasters that have facilitated the spread of fake news. It is absolutely, as you said, something of great concern.
Well, it also seems like an interesting moment that could possibly only have happened with all the different players that we have. We have the fake sites, we have the social media, we have the capability, and we have a president-elect who lives on social media. And we remember when Donald Trump would repeat things on the campaign trail. For instance, when a man rushed the stage, he tweeted out, he was a member of ISIS. And when asked if that was true, he said, well, I don't know. All I know is what's on the internet. Your thoughts there?
Or what's on television. Yeah. I mean, Donald Trump would often frame his accusations by saying, people are saying X. I have heard that Y. And so what he's essentially doing is that a bit like somebody passing along an email or passing along a Facebook or Twitter post, he's distancing himself from the provenance of the claim and essentially saying, well, if I saw it, if it came to my attention, then it's worth me passing along to thousands of people, both in my direct audience and people who might be watching this rally on television or online. And so this is an environment right now, I think, where truth is really, really difficult to verify because there's so much stuff that's floating around that is dubious. And we have a president-elect right now who is passing along a lot of dubious information because he finds it interesting and he particularly finds it sort of in jiving with his personal philosophy.
We also have a new member of his team, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's chief strategist, Joshua Green from Bloomberg Businessweek, talked to NPR's On the Media over the weekend, into Fresh Air before that, about a kind of circular energy here. Steve Bannon, yes, was once the head of Breitbart News, which he said was a platform for alt-right sites. But he also co-founded a nonprofit research organization called the Government Accountability Institute that feverishly produced reports against Hillary Clinton starting back in the 90s, with the goal of getting those reports into mainstream papers like the Washington Post, so that Breitbart News could then report that the Washington Post reported on this report from the Government Accountability Institute, so it must be true.
It's an amazing game of provenance, a kind of daisy chain of integrity. It really is the sort of thing that I think makes a lot of people, wonder what exactly Steve Bannon's role in this administration is going to be, since he sort of rose to fame as a propaganda merchant, as a very successful propaganda merchant for the alt-right with Breitbart and other sites. Is he going to be doing the same thing for the administration? And I think it is worth being concerned. I should say overall, if there are, conservative listeners out there, that I to a certain extent, liberals have done this as well. People who are moderates, people who are apolitical, have passed along information who they cannot individually verify. We are all at one point or another guilty of passing along what one might call fake news. But if you look at the fake news ecosystem as it currently exists, it certainly seems to be skewed toward pro-Donald Trump stories or anti-Hillary Clinton stories, to be more exact.
Well, Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, we can tell you for sure there are many conservative listeners to Here and Now. We always appreciate hearing from them. And the Oxford Dictionary recently named post-truth the word of the year. It's defined as relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.